New Year 2025, everyone. This is Cheryl Sampson Ramirez. We are excited to bring to you another gem in the archive, Critical Embodied Wellness for Educators, featuring Dr. Stephanie Carriaga, Associate Professor at California State University, Dominguez Hills. The host for this episode is Sheena Katz. We are exploring what are some strategies for educators in this current climate and how can they practice wellness. We hope that you enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone. Magandang araw. Welcome to episode 10 of season 4 for Philippine X in Wellness podcast. I'm your host, Sheena Katz, and my pronouns are she and her. For this episode's audio description, currently I am wearing a black long sleeve shirt. My hair is down. I have some gold hoop earrings on, and I'm seated in front of an impressionist painting behind me. Following our last episode, Hormonal Health 101 with Dr. Jacqueline Tolentino, this month, we will be talking about critical embodied wellness for educators with Associate Professor for California State University, Dominguez Hills, Department of Teacher Education, Dr. Stephanie Carriaga.
Hi.
So as mentioned in our previous episodes, all views discussed are for informational and educational purposes only. It is not meant to be medical advice, nor does it constitute therapy or professional advice. Always consult with your healthcare practitioner, especially before starting any exercise or new health program or qualified mental health professional for your particular condition. So without further ado, welcome Dr. Steph Carriaga.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We're so glad you're here, and we like to typically open our episodes by getting to know our guests a little bit more and where they're from. So from your knowledge, where are both sides of your family from in the Philippines, and where are you currently streaming from today?
So first of all, hi.
Hello.
So happy to be invited to come on this podcast. I'm Steph Carriaga. My pronouns are she, her. For the audio description, I have long brown hair that's like swoops to the side. I have brown lipstick on. I have some orange monarch beaded earrings as a nod to my family that loves butterflies. I'm wearing kind of a patterns collared shirt that has all kinds of different colors, blue, red, yellow. And I'm also wearing a red and white keffiyeh, which is a Palestinian headscarf that's a symbol of resistance against genocide, specifically by the Israeli government. And so my origins, so on my mom's side is from Baguio City, but I believe my grandpa Lino also comes from Candon. And then on my dad's side is from Pangasinan, specifically San Roque. And also I think my grandpa Pete was from Cabanatuan. I wish I knew more about all the other lineages. And so that's something, you know, that I'm constantly trying to learn more and feel into. And currently I am tuning in from Tongvaland, otherwise known as Long Beach, California.
Very cool. I'm very nearby. I'm in Marina Del Rey.
Awesome.
Great. So let's dive in a little bit into your professional background. So you're currently an associate professor at Cal State Dominguez Hills Department of Teacher Education. You received your master's in education and PhD at UCLA in social sciences and comparative education. And your dissertation was titled Pedagogies of Wholeness, Cultivating Critical Healing Literacies with Students of Color in an Embodied English Classroom. We'd love to learn more about your dissertation. You know, what led you to focus on this topic? And more importantly, what were your findings?
Okay. It's funny because I'm in my sixth year as an associate professor, so it's been a minute since I did the dissertation. So it's good to talk about it again because it does anchor a lot of the work that I do now as a teacher educator. because I work with folks who are becoming teachers or getting their master's degree in education. But I think the roots of my dissertation work was first being a high school English teacher. So I taught first at Luzinger High School in Lawndale in the South Bay, and then eventually made my way to Watts at Locke High School. And I was able to be a teacher for 6 years. And by the sixth year, I was experiencing burnout. What I later learned was more like push out, because there was a lot of things that were happening. One that I wasn't trained for in my credential program. I was experiencing a lot of secondary trauma, which is what happens when you're exposed to working with students or communities who are experiencing different kinds of trauma. And it starts manifesting in your body, in your relationships, in your health, in your emotions, in your mood. And so, you know, I got to the point where I tell this story often where, you know, I was driving slower to school, as you say, in the morning. And it was just like my body knew that there was something off. And I, you know, there was a lot of resistance there. And it wasn't so much the students, you know, I really love the students. And I do grieve leaving the classroom earlier than I wanted to. But the conditions weren't in place to really support students on a holistic level. And then at the same time, the conditions were also weren't in place to actually take care of ourselves as teachers either. And so there were different things that happened, and I've written about eventually having a miscarriage, actually, my sixth year of teaching. And that kind of catapulted me into actually thinking about wellness and healing in my own body, because I was literally forced to stop and grieve through this like huge loss that I was experiencing. And I ended up taking a month off from teaching, and I came back, and eventually, you know, I kind of started to refocus my teaching more on healing. And I had an amazing unit at the end of the semester with students, but it still wasn't enough. And so I decided to take a break from teaching. And then eventually, you know, I wanted to study in grad school what I felt was lacking. And so my dissertation is about how trauma impacts students of color, but also the teachers that serve these students. And I was specifically interested in how do you develop healing curriculum in an English classroom? Because, you know, in the English classroom, it's so beautiful that you get to hear these stories, you build connections with students, but nobody really trained me what the impact what impact those stories can have on us as teachers as well. And also ways that we can support students to not just tell their stories, but actually heal from the things that come up in some of their stories as well. And so, yeah, I ended up teaching an 11th grade English class in South Central. And I focused specifically on developing curriculum that focus on students to get to know their bodies more. We practice a lot of mindfulness. I chose a lot of texts that were specifically about healing. So we read Gloria Anzaldúa's work, a Chicana feminist, about these different paths of healing. And students wrote their stories. And then we did a unit on grief. And again, similar to my sixth year of teaching, unexpected kind of grief erupted again. And this time it was my mom. She ended up getting diagnosed with leukemia during like right before I was about to teach this unit on grief. And so, yeah, it was this interesting interplay of like helping students be with their bodies, feel, learn how to express their feelings. And then at the same time, me going through this big rupture in my own family, because, you know, my mom was my rock. She helped raise my kids. She helped advocate for me to go to school because my dad wasn't trying to have me leave LA, you know, to go to the Bay when I went to Berkeley for school. And so, yeah, it was a lot. And so the dissertation really was about learning to be in your body, even when it's difficult. and the ways that as a teacher, you can cultivate conditions of safety and courage for students to do the same. So that's a little bit about my dissertation.
Wow, that's incredible. It sounds like you really tapped into the parallel life experiences that led you to centering on the healing in your work, right? Which is, I'm sure, resonated more with your students because it was coming from a very real place.
Yeah. And, you know, often what I find happens when I do this work where I invite folks to be in their bodies in a school setting, whether it's a high school classroom or even a classroom at Dominguez Hills where these folks are becoming teachers, right? There's like a super awkward vibe because we've been taught in schools not to feel.
Yep.
Right. We've been taught that feeling is either unprofessional. That's what I was told when I was a teacher in so many different ways, that feeling is often too much, specifically for folks of color, specifically for Black, Indigenous folks, trans folks, queer folks, anybody who is on the margins of society, right? Like it feels like it's too much. And on the other side of that, when you can cultivate a sense of an environment where it's okay to feel and there's no like right or wrong way to feel, it's interesting what happens in the classroom where, you know, every time I've done like, I do these things called mindful minutes in all of my class where we just start off class not talking about curriculum, just really doing different activities, whether it's like guided breathing or just pausing and listening to music or coloring. And just these kind of really micro things, if you keep practicing them consistently, it creates an amazing shift in classrooms that I feel like is necessary, not just for students, but also for teachers themselves, because it gives them permission to be human and not just be a teacher. Like I actually love experiencing mindful minutes with students because then I just get to vibe out with them, you know?
That's incredible. The fact that you start off your class saying it's okay to feel is already kind of a game changer because I never heard that in my classrooms growing up.
Yeah.
So let's hone in on the title of our episode, which is Critical Embodied Wellness for Educators. This, I believe, is also the title of a professional development opportunity that you offered at Casa Dominguez Hills, where educators can learn, practice, and enact wellness strategies to better care for themselves, students, and school communities. This is definitely still a very current and relevant topic for educators, as you know. So who did you have in mind when you developed this course and what did you hope to address? I know you were pulling from your own experiences, but who were you building it for?
For me?
Yeah.
First and foremost, like it was something that it was a space similar, you know, to my dissertation work. It was a space that I feel like I didn't have as a teacher. And it's for, I'm part of different communities, like the People's Education Movement, which is like a grassroots teacher organizer space that started in LA, and there's chapters in the Bay and in Chicago. But I'm also just, you know, by way of being in the field of education, connected to other folks who are critical minded, who understand that schooling causes harm to young people, both historically and in the present moment. And they're not designed for us to be free. And so what I wanted to create was a space where, like I said before, we are given permission to feel, but also recognizing that feeling is hard, right? When you have been trained and conditioned to not feel, to think it's not safe to feel, you can't just tell someone to feel, right?
Right.
It takes practice. It takes a lot of vulnerability of folks who are facilitating. And the other reason why I created Critical Embodied Wellness for Educators is because I eventually did this one training when I was in graduate school, when I was getting my PhD. And it was one of the last trainings, I think, in LA at the time. And it's called Generative Somatics. And it's led by Stacey Haynes, or it was led by Stacey Haynes at the time. And Prentice Hemphill was also an instructor, and other folks. And I don't know if folks have heard of somatics. I think it's going around in the wellness community more these days. And I know that words can often like confuse things, but I think for me, somatics is about learning to get in touch with the knowing that you have in your body. And when we talk about body, body is not just like this physical container that we have. It's also the body that is shaped by our ancestors, by our history. It's shaped by the folks we're in relationship with. It's shaped by the folks we're fighting against. It's shaped by structures of oppression. And so all of that lives right in your body. And the one thing that we all have access to, but we're not really one, remembering that we actually have and that we need to take care of, but also it's a source of storytelling. It's a source of healing. It's a source of transformation. Like, how do we center the body as a space for inquiry, to get to know ourselves more? Like, what triggers us, what our wounds are, what our desires are, what our purpose is as educators. Because oftentimes, again, when we're in the grind of teaching, and I imagine in other occupations as well, we're often taken away from all of those things, right? Through capitalism, through all kinds of stuff, because we're forced to be compliant or productive, or again, quote unquote, professional, right? And it makes us forget that there's this big resource that we can learn from. And from being with that resource with ourselves, that then ripples into the way that we show up with our students. And so, yeah, that's what CREW is, Critical Embodied Wellness for Educators. And so somatics is not just about like healing in the body. It's about studying the body, like really noticing and being aware, like what shows up when you're stressed out, what shows up when you're tired, what shows up when that person is pissing you off, what shows up when that student is activating all kinds of stuff, what shows up when you feel shut down and you're disconnected from other folks, right? And all of these are good information to get to know ourselves more and what our limitations are, and perhaps what our old stories are and what our wounds and some traumas and stressors might be, so that we can make sense of them and then be able to be a more whole teacher with students. So it's about studying the body, but also practicing. So a big component of CREW is that we choose different practices to be in our body at least once a day. Because in the world of somatics, they say that, you know, in order to practice something and make it like muscle memory, you have to practice it at least 300 times, right? And then to move from muscle memory into like embodiment, like even when there's pressure around you, this is something that is like comes authentically from your body, even when you're stressed out, like it takes 3,000 times to do. And so what we try to stress is like choose something that helps you be in your body. And it's usually really simple. It's like pausing, right? Like we can just give a pause. We can notice like what's happening in our bodies, or it can be something connected to nature. It could be something about around rest. We had one participant who's still in CREW this semester. He would take naps during his prep period. So like intentional rest, right? It's not just practicing to do it, but it's like intentional for the sake of something. And usually it's for the sake of refusing the violence of schooling. Because schooling often tells us you don't deserve to rest. Or it'll tell us if you're overwhelmed, then just disconnect from everything instead of actually stay engaged in the conflict, right? And so it's this idea of kind of remapping all the different stuff that happens in our body, our mind, our spirit, and to see some kind of change that happens from the inside out.
I'm so glad that you clarified somatic, because that you're right. That is popping up. That term is popping up in a lot of wellness practices today, but not really talking about the root of it. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
So speaking of self-care, you know, when telling educators to prioritize self-care, this can sometimes be met with eyes rolled or pushback from educators, right? Asking for increased mental health support, smaller classroom sizes, even adult support in the classroom, coupled with a decrease in instructional demands. What are some of the strategies that you talk about in your course, other ones, to establish and maintain critical embodied wellness for educators? I know you mentioned a couple of different examples, but is there anything else that could be helpful that you talk about in your course?
Yeah, well, I think one good thing is to kind of back up a bit before even talking about practice and just talk about this idea of self-care. I know there's like some folks who are like, no, I have to take care of myself. That's really important, right? And then there's the other group of folks who are like, no, it's about collective care, right? It's not just about the self, because that could be self-centered. And then that's like reinforcing all kinds of other stuff, right? And I, through my different studies and just through the different teachers that I've been exposed to throughout my life, I draw a lot from Black and Brown feminists. So like Gloria Anzaldúa, I mentioned before, but bell hooks as well. And so bell hooks talks about how for Black feminists, the self is not something that is tied, that is not disconnected from other things, right? The self is always going to be connected to community, whether it's your family, your ancestors, your larger community, your culture, all of that stuff, right? And so I actually find the binary distinction between self and collective care to be incongruent with what we try to practice in critical embodied wellness for educators, right? I think it goes along with this idea of kapwa that I've heard, you know, in Filipino culture. Chicana folks say in Lakesh, right? You are my other me, right? And so it's like, I take care of myself, yes, because I deserve to take care of myself, but I also take care of myself because I know I'm connected to others and I want to be of service to others, right? And I know it can get tricky because sometimes taking care of ourselves might then again be connected to like productivity and like, you know, and that can lead to burnout. And so I actually think it's important to still talk about self-care, especially from a feminist perspective, because often it's the women or the femme folks who are often asked to take on emotional labor, right? Who are often told to sacrifice themselves at the expense of the community. And so I think it's equally important to talk about self and collective care and talk about how those are related to each other, right? And so, yeah, I just wanted to share that. And then in terms of practices, yeah, there's a lot, right? In our latest cohort, so we had a second cohort of crew this semester. And every cohort, we invite different teachers, guest teachers, to practice different kinds of embodied wellness with us from different lenses. And we wanted to really connect to the elements this semester. And so when we talked about land and the earth, I invited somebody named Nenu Cruz, who is a teacher of Rayitos de Sol. And they actually taught my own kids in an outdoor dual language Spanish program. But it's beautiful because it's like very, I don't think Nenu explicitly calls it this, but it is decolonial in that it's teaching young folks to be, I mean, they're already connected to the land, right? Young folks are already connected. So it's like really cherishing that and channeling that through different ways of being out in nature. And so we basically went to a nature park in Long Beach on Tongva land, and Nenu invited us to do what's called a forest bath. I don't know if you've heard of a forest bath.
I have it. Tell us about it.
It's basically just like a mindful walk, right? And again, going back to somatics, it's like noticing what comes up in your body. What is your body telling you through what it's doing? And then also, how do you practice something that's intentional that brings about some kind of change that you want, right? So often folks would notice, like, as soon as they started, like, what was supposed to be like a mindful walk through the park, because it's beautiful, right? There's trees, there's like, there's just animals everywhere, there's sounds, there's smells. But the teachers in the cohort would notice how fast they were walking, right?
Like interesting.
By default, right? Because the body is also like, it carries habits, right? And those habits usually protect us from something. And so usually teachers find themselves just moving really fast because we have to do the thing, right? We have to produce the thing. We have to get to the curriculum. We got to get to fifth period or whatever. And so when they notice that, they're like, okay, yeah, thank you. And Nenu invited us to really just, like, it's super simple. Notice your heel and your toe hit the earth. And so as soon as folks practice doing that and really kind of noted their feet on the earth, things started to slow down. They started to notice more around them, the beautiful spider webs, the birds, the butterflies, the sounds. And then all of a sudden that started making connections to their grandparents who used to take them to wherever, you know? And so again, it's this idea of like just through simple little practices and being intentional about it and practicing awareness and compassionate awareness, it just opens up all these different kinds of possibilities. So yeah, that's the forest path.
I love that your kids join. How did they like it, or how did it resonate with them?
I mean, it's amazing. I always tell Nenu that we're so grateful, especially we found Rayitos de Sol during the pandemic.
Oh, wow.
So there was a lot of grief happening, you know, collectively around, especially young people being disconnected from their schools and their friends and the teachers that they love, right? And so luckily, they started doing this outdoor program that felt safer for us, right, at the time. My youngest child, Lino, who is named after my grandpa, my mom's dad, I learned that when they have big feelings, one way that helps them kind of come back to themselves and come back to the present is to be able to connect to a tree. Now they can't always climb a tree. It's not the most accessible thing, but like, that's good to know, right? To know that just by connecting to nature, like, it can help you regulate your emotions. It can help you become more present. But also, again, like in a compassionate way, right? Because oftentimes in schools, there's this new kind of upstream of social emotional learning, which is great. But oftentimes the way it's taught is like, okay, you're mad. Okay, well, let's figure out how to calm down. Okay, you're calmed down. Okay, now let's learn this thing, right? Versus, oh, you're angry. Let's figure out why you're angry. What did somebody hurt your feelings? Is there something you want to communicate to that person who hurt your feelings, right? That comes more from a compassionate place of like getting to know what's showing up for you and in this relationship or ruptured relationship, instead of like, let's just do this thing that sounds good in order to just keep doing the same thing we keep doing in schools that actually harms children.
That's incredible. And the fact that you found all this during the pandemic is crazy. And great.
Yeah. We're very, very lucky. And they still go through the program on like a seasonal basis in the summer. So we're really happy.
That's wonderful. So being that we are Philippine X in Wellness, we know that you've refereed journal articles with Filipino educators such as Dr. Patrick Camagnan at University of San Francisco and Dr. Tracy Lechica Buena Vista at Cal State Northridge. So in your collaboration with them, what were some of the elements that you see that are rooted in our Filipino-American community, such as intergenerational trauma, that are also paralleled among students of color in urban U.S. public schools?
Yeah, I mean, I think the common thread between the different pieces that I collaborated on with one, Patrick Camagnan, so I want to give a shout out to Cam. He is one of my like mano mentors, and we published a piece about social emotional learning, and it talks about how social emotional learning can be a form of miseducation, kind of similar to what I was sharing before, right? If it doesn't come from a place of wanting to work towards freedom instead of just perpetuating and reinforcing the violence that we already see in schools. And yeah, so that's that piece. I'm going to get to your question. I'm going to kind of go in a circle.
Yeah,
so that's that piece. And then one of the pieces that I published with Dr. Tracy La Chica Buenavista, who is also like a Manang mentor, femtor of mine, also Ilocano. We collaborated on a couple of different things. But one of the things that I'm thinking about is we collaborated on a piece with other scholars, including Ed Kurameng, and Sharima Porkhorshid, about cis, hold on, cis heteropatriarchy. Us academics like to use long ass words. I'm sorry.
So that is a very long word.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. But basically talking about how in critical educator spaces, right? So educators who are focused on justice, sometimes we don't pause to actually acknowledge that the harm that we're trying to fight against, we actually often replicate in our smaller communities against each other, right? Specifically about gender violence. And so all that to say, so those two pieces combined, right? I think when I try to connect it to the Filipino-American community, I think what all of those pieces combined help us to understand is that when we are experiencing trauma or conflict, often kind of the mainstream lens is to just attack what's happening in the present moment as like an interpersonal issue, right? But what we try to uplift is that whatever conflicts that we see, whether it's like an internal conflict that shows up as an emotion, or it's an interpersonal conflict where maybe folks are beefing with each other or somebody said something that was, can I cuss on here? Yes. So somebody said something fucked up and thank you. Somebody said something that was problematic, right? Against a woman, right? From a cisgender man to a woman. All of these are important to address, but we can get to better solutions if we actually widen our lens. And I'm kind of moving my hand so the audio description, right? Like widen our lens to think about the historical traumas that we have experienced as a people that then shapes how we show up with each other, right? And so I can share from like one of the stories that I've written about in another piece specifically about anger, right? So my grandma Mary, so that's my dad's mom. She took care of my dad for 13 years in the Philippines from the day he was born, by herself, but with family and everything, but not with her husband at the time, my grandpa Pete, because my grandpa Pete ended up migrating from the Philippines to Hawaii. He was the first one to come here, and he worked in the sugarcane fields and sent money back. And so, you know, I'm grateful to my grandpa Pete, and, you know, it was a long time, and he ended up meeting another woman and all of this stuff, right? And so 13 years later, he was able to petition my grandma and my dad to Hawaii. And she gets to Hawaii, and she's not happy. And my dad would often describe how she would have these like outbursts and he didn't know what to do with it. And you know, there's this awesome story where she was about to fight the woman that my grandpa was seeing. Like she went to the house and started throwing rice at her door. I don't know, something crazy. And I was like, that's where I'm getting it from. And yeah, so there was a lot of anger in the house, right? And so if you move another generation to my family, when I grew up in my house, my relationship with anger was always one of fear, because my dad would also erupt, right? And I didn't know what he was mad about. And because, you know, I'm a Pisces, right? And so for the folks who are, you know, astro heads, know that Pisces are very like naturally feeling, intuitive people. and can kind of blend into other people's feelings. And so I did a lot of that as a young person. But it ended up being to the point where I was more concerned about other people's feelings instead of mine, right? And that's just like my dad's side. And so I have a lot of empathy for my grandma. She would say things to my dad in Ilocano. I forgot how to say it in Ilocano, but she would basically say, oh, agawi dakon, like, it's time to go back home. This is not home, right? And so this all disrupts the whole story of like the American dream, right? We come here for a better life, which we do have a great life. Like, I want to recognize and acknowledge that, you know, I have a lot of privileges because my grandpa Pete was able to come here and then pave the way for the rest of us to come here, right? And I wonder what would have happened if, you know, imperialism didn't impact the Philippines, where there's this necessity to leave our homeland and come here. And also the relationship of anger to that, right? This unprocessed, unmetabolized anger that continues to show up through generations because maybe we're not given the language to talk about it, or maybe we're not given the permission to talk about it because we should be quote unquote grateful, right, that we're here. And so, yeah, I think a lot of the work that I'm trying to do now as a mother and also as an educator is to, again, when anger shows up, as hard as it is, how do I work with somatic practitioners? How do I work with my ancestors? How do I work with myself and my community to develop a courage to be with that anger, so that I can make meaning of it and that I don't start to pass it on, this fear of anger, to my own kids? And it's not perfect, right? Like, I still erupt, and I can show you right here, like, this is a hole that I kicked in my wall during the pandemic. I wrote a piece about that. This is all in the same piece. And so, yeah, it's an ongoing process. And again, going back to Black and Brown feminists, it's like Gloria Anzaldúa says that there is no like end to healing. It's only just a continual process, right? So I try to remember that for the sake of my own kids and their descendants and the young people that I'm working with and the teachers that I'm working with who are also working with young people, right? It's like, what do we want to pass on? Do we want to pass on an avoidance of our feelings and the messages that we have in our bodies? Or do we want to actually reclaim those? Because we do need anger sometimes, especially right now.
Absolutely. That's a great segue for our next question, which may be a little bit of a deeper question, but would love to know what your thoughts are and how we can support educators in addressing students' wellness needs with the upcoming administration.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah. So I think, you know, in this moment, there's so many different ways, I think, to fight against and resist and acknowledge like the challenges that we're up against. So I'm thinking about how, you know, our undocumented students, students who are immigrants and that are facing a lot of fear, right? I'm thinking about our LGBTQ students who might be afraid of being themselves and being more openly themselves in this climate. I'm thinking of our Black students and our Black communities. And again, this isn't new, but it feels like it's a return to another Trump administration in which it is more permissible to actually just do all this shit out loud, right? So it's not new, but it's much more in our face and it's much more explicit and it could be much more violent, right? And kind of like drawing from my work around understanding trauma and stress and what it does to our bodies and what it does to our relationships. I think the biggest thing for me and my own role and what I know how to do and to facilitate is to create safe spaces for folks to feel through what they're experiencing. Because oftentimes when we are stressed out and when we're up against something, the default is to just keep going and to like fight. And sometimes that fight response is not very precise. Sometimes we end up fighting against the folks that actually we should be building with, right?
Right.
Or another automatic stress or trauma response is to avoid and just be like, this is shit is too much. I'm going to disengage. I'm good. Bye-bye. Right. And again, all of these responses are really important and we need them. And when we can create safe spaces or brave spaces to actually feel through what we're experiencing, we can be more mindful about how we want to move forward. Right. You know, oftentimes I've been a teacher educator for 6 years now at Cal State Dominguez Hills, and we've gone through a pandemic, like we've gone through different crises at this point, right? And I think at this point, we're going to continue going through different crises even after Trump's administration. And so what I noticed that happens when crisis hits is that folks just keep piling shit on.
Yep.
It's like, we got to do this, you know, and it's good. Like I feel that push, that pull. Like I'm usually the person that's like, I need to create a list of resources. And, you know, and it's great. And I wonder, learning from surviving the pandemic, for those of us who did survive, because not all of us did, and those of us who have survived different kinds of crises, how can we learn from those experiences to make our response in this moment more sustainable and more focused? And oftentimes, what administrations like this do that are rooted in white supremacy and patriarchy and transphobia and all these things, they want to draw on our fear. They want to perpetually put us in a state of fear so that we actually don't focus on protecting and loving ourselves, right? Because we're always protecting or being hypervigilant, waiting. And again, those things are important, but sometimes it's a matter of like pausing just long enough to figure out like, what is the right thing to do in this moment? And perhaps sometimes the right thing to do is to do less, right? Because oftentimes when we're stressed, we can't do more because like our brains are not really operating and functioning at the same level. So I would say, as hard as it is, in the areas that we can, we create spaces to feel with each other to make sense of that. And we create spaces to pause and to rest because we're going to need each other for the long haul.
That makes sense. And drawing from your experience, because you've had a couple of different instances, I'm curious, are you seeing a difference between the K-12 versus college or university educators when it comes to their wellness needs?
As someone who has become an academic, and has gotten, you know, that terminal degree of a PhD and has been in the academy for what, K-12 plus 2 more years plus 4 or 5 more years, like all those years combined in school. I think what schooling does to you is Bettina Love, another educational scholar, she talks about spirit murdering.
What is spirit murdering?
I mean, murder's a spirit. It makes you think, but you have to operate a certain way. And, you know, the higher you get in these institutions, which is the same thing as like becoming president, right? It's like the higher you become and you try to push through these different institutions that are founded in all kinds of violence and genocide and erasure and punishment, it does something to you because you get rewarded for acting a certain way, right? You get rewarded for being competitive. You get rewarded for not taking breaks. You get rewarded for, you know, advertising yourself, like all this stuff, right?
It's glorified as a positive thing.
Yeah. And it does something to your psyche and your spirit and your body. I feel like the higher you get up in the academy or in higher education, or on the other hand, becoming a teacher and then being one of the gatekeepers of these institutions, right? Like you start to drink the Kool-Aid a lot. And I think what happens is, for me at least, and you know, this is, I learned this through being a teacher and making a lot of mistakes, is that you have to know when to refuse things, and you have to know what boundaries to set, and you have to know to remember what actually matters to you, because all kinds of shit will be thrown at you, things that you supposedly have to do. And it's okay to question, like, do we really need to do this right now? And so for me, yeah, I feel like the longer you are in schooling, from K to 12 to higher education, the more that you are exposed to this quote unquote spirit murdering. And so you have to create those spaces of protection and release too, right? I think a lot of it is also grieving, because sometimes you're forced to do things that you don't want to do. And that also takes a toll on your spirit, right? As a teacher, I had to test my students all the time. I had to do these different assignments that I didn't think was that helpful to them. And even when I teach my credential students, folks who are becoming teachers, there's all kinds of stuff that California makes us do. And so, yeah, it's a lot of like releasing the stuff that is imposed upon you, having compassion for the ways that you've navigated. And, you know, we're not perfect, and it's hard to be in this kind of in-between space of knowing institutions are violent and being part of the institution, but while also trying to fight against it at the same time.
And now I know that you've seen it with your own practice, but looking at others and your students, what outcomes have you observed in students or educators who do engage in critical embodied wellness practices? Are there any good case studies or examples you can share of, you know, how you've seen it benefit someone else's day to day?
Yeah. So we recently put out a blog piece about Crew, and that was published through an organization called the School Crisis Recovery and Renewal Project. Again, more words, but it's CRR. And that, for educators who are interested in wellness, and educators is like expansive, like you could be a social worker, you could be an administrator, you could be a teacher. Like there's so many resources on how to deal with crisis, but also practice wellness for yourself and for students. So that's an amazing resource. But we got invited to write a piece about Crew after doing the first cohort last year. And so I wrote a piece with Melissa Marin. And so Melissa is a restorative justice practitioner from the Bay Area, Alameda to be specific. I believe that's Ohlone land. And she wrote about her experience as a student in or a participant in the cohort. And what she chose to do as a practice was body scans. So it's just, you know, intentionally every day scanning the body. And, you know, different body scans look different based off of different lineages. But the way she would do it is she would just start either from the top or bottom of her body and just start to notice, like, how does my scalp feel? How does my forehead feel? How do my cheeks feel? And anytime she would come across something that was challenging or interesting, she would pause there and just kind of like listen and be with it. And what's interesting is that she noticed, one, how hard it was, because it's hard, and she identified as a Black queer woman. It's hard for folks who are marginalized in different ways to be with your body, because you've often been conditioned or taught that it's not safe. You might be punished. You might be seen as too much. And so it was difficult. And then she would also notice that, actually, I have a lot of ailments right now. Like, my body actually doesn't feel good. So I also want to offer that, like, you know, embodied wellness and practices, it's not always going to feel good, you know? Like, we want to feel good, but sometimes the learning also comes from being able to be with our pain. Because sometimes we're also trained not to be with our pain, right? It's seen as a weakness, or you're too vulnerable. But again, it's like that compassionate practice of being with yourself, whatever shows up. So she kept doing body scans. And what was beautiful is that We also, so in addition to practicing the body scans, we also study like our different trauma and stress responses that I mentioned earlier. And so she wanted to know more about her appease strategy. So this is another, you know, besides fight, flight, freeze, the three Fs, there's also fawn. And fawn is another word for appease, right? So if you think of a dog when they get in trouble and they try to make you, you know, they're wagging their tail, they look very, you know, nice so that they don't get in trouble. Like that's something that we learn as also animals, as human beings to do in order to protect ourselves in some way, or at least to like stay within a group, right? So as a teacher, I might practice appeasement automatically and saying yes to something because I want to be part of this field, of this job. But then I might recognize that, oh shit, I said yes, even though my body actually said no, right? And so she was studying that in her body as well. And so, yeah, she just talks about both how the body scan and learning to kind of notice the different things that come up in your body when you're starting to appease. Like for her, she noticed it's like the automatic
nodding,
the smiling, like I'm non-threatening, so let me smile. Let me show that I'm just this pleasant person. And also, like, for me, when I appease, my body tends to go forward because I want to, like, really pay attention to the person that, you know, on a really deep end, like, I'm afraid of. Like, I'm afraid of maybe losing you. So I'm going to really pay attention to how I can appease you and stay in this relationship, right? And also noticing that when you appease habitually, it can also, on the other end, while it helps you belong to a group maybe or stay in a group, what it also does is it conditions us to disappear our own needs, right? We start forgetting our own stuff. We don't recognize when there's actually a no in our body. And so, yeah, all of these things were happening. And she was able to recognize when her appease shows up and also how to transform it and be like, no, I'm not going to appease. I'm actually going to hold a boundary. And so, yeah, it's a beautiful piece about what many teachers learn to do.
That's incredible, just her gaining that self-awareness. And then for our listeners who may not know a lot about it, body scans, do we just start from the very top of our head to the bottom?
Yeah. I mean, we could do one right now. So, yeah, so a body scan is, so what I try to teach in embodied, critical embodied wellness is that we don't just jump to the practice. We also have to cultivate some safety, some groundedness so that it gives us a good environment in to feel, right? And so before even body scanning, we can just take a few breaths, just noticing our inhale and noticing our exhale. And then as we start to do that, maybe we start to notice how we're sitting in our seats. Start us to notice the environment around us, recognizing that we are in our home and this is a safe place for us. You can also kind of invite different energies into your space. So if that's ancestors or your pets or a color that makes you feel good, right? And then from that place, then you can start scanning, right? So you can scan the top of your head, your face. And as you scan, again, this is about just noticing. And even if the thoughts start to pop up, like, I don't feel shit, what's wrong with me? Right? And like, okay, thank you. Noted. And kind of coming back, right? And even if you don't feel anything, that's also good information, right? So you might feel something in different parts of your bodies, or you might notice it's neutral. You might notice there's pain. You might notice it feels good. And so you just keep going until you reach the end of your body or the bottom of your body. And then that's it. It can really literally just take like a minute or so. And you can also look up body scans. There's a lot of like meditations that do body scans. But what's good about this is that because we've been conditioned to not listen to our bodies, that means we don't know how it communicates with us. So the more that we do the body scans It's like getting in touch with that language again, right? Like, oh, I'm scrunching my forehead right now. That means I'm not with this right now. I didn't even know I often make this face and I don't know I'm doing it. Right? Or, you know, my gut is clenched right now. Maybe this doesn't feel safe for me. Or, you know, my heart is racing right now. And so maybe instead of saying yes, maybe I just pause before I say anything and say, hey, I don't have an answer for you right now. I'll come back to you when I'm ready to answer, right? So it's both about like studying what happens in the body, but also practicing pausing. Because that's another thing, right? In the capitalist society, we are just always going, 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 going. And that's something that is habitual within us. So the more we practice it, the more our body then knows it's okay to pause right now.
Thank you for explaining that. I wanted to make sure that we talk through it because you mentioned earlier that we're conditioned to not really feel. So that's a great way to kind of stop and try to feel.
Yeah. And I learned that another way to do that, because again, so for some of us, it might be hard to be with our body for different reasons. Everyone takes a shower, right? So when you take a shower, you use the water. And when the water touches different parts of your body, the water helps you pay attention to those different parts. So you can also, you know, access the elements to help you too.
So going back to what we talked about earlier a little bit, I wanted to circle back. When it comes to educators, you know, pushing back and setting the boundaries to really maintain their own sanity and wellness, that can sometimes lead to punitive measures. So what are some strategies that educators can put in place to handle that type of pushback from the organizations?
Yeah, so I think that's an important question, especially for right now. I think we're in a climate where there's already been pushback against so many different teachers, whether it's, like you said, taking care of yourself, but also advocating for students or advocating for Palestine, right? There's so many different instances in which educators have been put in these really hard places and to be super candid, like pushed out and fired, right? And I know so many educators in my community, myself included, who have been pushed out for advocating for different things. And so I think I want to answer it in a couple of different ways. So one of them is I always encourage folks to find your people. Whenever I am working with folks who are becoming teachers and like finding their placements, one of the things that I tell them to prioritize is to make sure that there's at least one person who is either like-minded, like-hearted, politically aligned, or supportive, right? Because you need, in this climate especially, you're going to need your people. And this is not something that you can do alone, nor should you do alone, right? And so at least in that way, you're not pushing back alone, you're pushing back with others, right? And then besides finding your people, it's also once you find the people, that's when you organize, right? And organize can take on different ways, can be literal like campaigns that folks will initiate to create better conditions for wellness at a school, whether it's the treatment of teachers or students or both. But it doesn't have to necessarily look like a campaign. It can be just noticing that there's a particular issue that's impacting wellness and that noticing who else is impacted by it, getting their stories. And then also bringing in folks who you know are good at protecting folks, right? Whether it's union, but I know in, you know, some charter schools, like in my own experience, the union is not that protective of folks. And so, again, these are not perfect answers. You might even still do those things and still be up against things. And so that's like my first part of the answer, right? And my second part of the answer is I think we also... What I'm learning from this moment in which there's so many different fights happening, right? So the fight for liberation in Palestine, the fight for against climate crisis, with this Trump administration, all the stuff that they're going to be, all the stuff that we're going to be up against. I think it's also a matter of knowing when you are equipped and ready to push back no matter what. And also learning how to take turns pushing back. Because, you know, there are some of us who have privilege. So I have tenure. And so because I have tenure, I know that I can speak up more.
Right.
I also know that I'm not Black, I'm not Palestinian, I'm not working class. And so, you know, all those different privileges that I might have, how do I leverage those? And how do I practice more risk and be more brave for the sake of protecting us all? Because all of these things that impact our wellness, it's not just something that impacts us individually. We all need each other. We all need each other to keep each other safe. And again, going back to that sustainability question, how do we take turns doing that? You know? And how do we also recognize that, like, hey, I've pushed and I can't do that anymore right now. Can somebody else do it? And so I think this is a time where we need to learn to, like, harness our tools of taking care of ourselves and also learn how to be brave and push back and experience whatever they're going to throw at us. And then, again, grieve whatever has been lost and then figure out how to stay in the fight, because we're going to be here for a long time. So all that to say is, I think the question was around, like, how do we respond to pushback against wellness? And I want to be really clear that I'm not defining wellness as individually taking care of ourselves. I'm defining wellness as collective care and taking care of all of us, and understanding that all of our struggles are intertwined.
That makes sense. And, you know, because we are a health and wellness podcast, we do also like to ask our guests about their own wellness routines and practices. So how do you balance being a mom, a wife, and a citizen professor amongst many roles that you play in your personal and professional arenas? You know, what does your own wellness and self-care practice look like?
Yeah, so I, through Generative Somatics, which I mentioned earlier with Stacey Haynes and Prentice Hemphill, I learned this practice called centering. And it's a combination of different things, but it's this practice that I do that helps me remember literally, like, the center of my body. For a lot of cultures, this is where we hold our power, our purpose. This is where we create, right? And so doing centering is like a combination of different practices of, like, being in your body, but also, like, intentionally practicing having dignity in your body. And one way that you do that is to just notice the length that you have in your body. Because oftentimes, again, by default, by habit, we might just kind of navigate the world slumped over. Whether, like, you can see it as I'm doing here, where I'm kind of hunched over, or internally, I might have that kind of just internal sense of, like, shame, right? Because, again, we live in a world that likes to shame folks. And so how do I practice, like, intentionally bringing and noticing dignity by, like, lengthening my spine, noticing my feet on the ground. For me, dignity is about, like, also connecting to the earth and noticing what's around me. So I try to practice that at least, like, 3 times a day. And one way I try to remember is I have these rings that were given to me by one of my grandmas.
Hold on.
Kind of take them off. So it's a bunch of gold thin rings on my finger, and so I'll move it on my other hand to kind of signify that I've done it for the day. Or sometimes I'll text my friends who are also doing a centering practice, so that we're accountable to each other. That's like the find your people thing, you know. That's one practice that I do. I also, every other week, I've started training in jiu-jitsu. Again, with my kid's teacher, because I was like, that looks fun. I want to do that too. And, you know, that's me taking care of my anger, like, kind of going back to the anger, the generational anger that I carry with me. It's like, how do I embrace that, you know? And through training, like it's really taught me that I have a lot of power and it's okay to like express that power in ways that are supportive, right? And so that's, yeah, that itself has been like a really big journey for me to move from like, oh my God, this is like scary, I don't know, to like, oh, this is exciting. This feels really good, you know? And yeah, so that's one practice. Trying to think, oh, another thing that I notice about myself, like I mentioned before, is like, you know, being a naturally empathetic person, I think I take on a lot of people's energies and stories, and I just noticed that I need solitude. And when I'm getting grumpy or really short with my kids, I'm like, oh crap, I think I need to give some time to myself, you know? So I try to also, luckily my schedule allows it where I intentionally just carve out time to be by myself, whether it's like going to the ocean, which I have the privilege of being next to, or just being in bed, and just like less stimulation, because I think oftentimes I'm just overstimulated and fatigued by it. And so those are like three little practices that I try to do on a regular basis as much as possible.
That's a very well-rounded set of practices that takes care of mindfulness, rage, and resting.
I'm trying. But it also echoes what I try to teach in crew, because those are pretty much the themes. Because the same person, again, who I train with, we invited her, Professor Zahalia of Raw Life Defense. She did some self-defense with crew. And then Liza Kasudin, another, I think Cheryl knows her, a Panay teacher here in Long Beach on Tongva land. She does restorative yoga. And so we started off with rest as well. And we started off with rest on purpose, because oftentimes we act like we have to deserve rest and that has to happen at the end. And so we started through with rest on purpose.
I like that you started with rest, because most people, like you said, feel that it needs to be earned.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm still working through that.
I think we all are.
Yeah.
So as we begin to close, how can our community reach you if they have any additional questions, which I know they will?
Let's see. So we have an Instagram. So our Instagram handle is crew, C-R-E-W, 4-ED, 4-E-D. So C-R-E-W, 4-E-D. And you can... We have some highlights there. I believe there's a link to the blog piece that I mentioned earlier. And the next time we recruit a new cohort, that's where we post the application for it. So that's where you can learn more about crew. I feel like if you do like a Google Scholar search for Stephanie Cariaga, you can find the different pieces that I've mentioned. But I'm also happy to share links for this episode too, as well. And my Instagram is like a combination of like personal, professional things, which is basically what I try to practice anyway. Like I like to have boundaries, but I also like, I want to be a human being and a scholar and teacher at the same time. So my Instagram handle is whoobubz, H-O-O-B-U-B-Z. Shout out to my brothers, my two monongs, for giving me that random ass nickname got stuck.
And for people who may want to apply for crew in the future, are there any qualifications they need to have just to apply?
Oh, good question. So there is an application, and what we try to do is be intentional about selecting folks that have at least 1 year of experience as an educator. So that way you have experiences to draw from in your learning and crew. And the way we define educator is super expansive. Like it could be teachers, social workers, administrators, paraeducators, homeschool teachers. Like as long as you work with students in some capacity, whether directly or indirectly, we see you as an educator. And so again, at least 1 year of experience. The other criteria is that you have an understanding that systems of oppression exist and that we need to resist them, and that you are ready to have a commitment of joining CREW, which is a 6-month commitment of 6 meetings, roughly like once a month. And so far it's been in Cal State Dominguez Hills. We have an in-person cohort this year, but we also have a virtual cohort, and those folks are joining from like all over the place. So that's how we run it. And I'm going to be going on like an incubation period. Speaking of rest, I'm going to go on sabbatical. And so what we're going to do is go more internal with developing CREW, and I'm hoping to write a book about CREW. So that's what my sabbatical is for. But when we come back, we'll be relaunching the next cohort.
That's incredible. Thank you for creating that space for everyone who needs it. So final words, is there anything else that you would like a community to know when it comes to critical embodied wellness for educators?
I think the one thing I like to tell folks in CREW is just to don't forget you have a body, and your body is here. It has helped you survive this far. It's a beautiful, powerful vessel that we have. And so there's so many different ways to get in touch with it and learn from it. It doesn't have to look like CREW. We all have cultural and ancestral ways of connecting to our bodies too. And so, yeah, just remember we have bodies and they're here to help us heal.
I love that. Thank you again, Dr. Carriaga, for joining us today. You know, we look forward to witnessing your journey unfold as you continue to offer support from academia. We will continue to, of course, share your upcoming opportunities as we stay connected in partnership.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. And to our community, for our next episode in line with Lunar New Year, we'll be talking with acupuncturist Rose Palma about perimenopause and menopause. Stay tuned for that episode. Stay tuned for that episode, which will launch on Wellness Wednesday, February 12th. And as we close, we'd like to acknowledge once again our guest speaker, Dr. Stephanie Carriaga, Liza Gesudin, for referring her to us, our graphic designer and producer for our opening and closing track, Richie, our advisors, Allison De La Cruz, Rian De Los Reyes, and Sofo Tiologo, our community partners, SoCal Filipinos, the Filipino American Life, Rising Filipinas, Therapy Nai, and all of our community members for your shares and support. As always, we'll make sure to share our guests' offering on our IG stories and highlights for permanent access for any of their upcoming events. Please be sure to follow us at Philippine X and Wellness on IG, Threads, Facebook, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Don't forget to continue to hit like and subscribe on our Philippine X and Wellness YouTube channel. Be well, everyone. Continue to take care of yourselves. Maraming salamat.
Thank you again, Madak. Tell me.